You're an electrician, too. You just didn't know.
Just need to verify that we're picking this up. And that, and I think we're all right. Let me begin then by indicating that today is December 15th, and this is Jim Boning with Bernadette McNulty speaking with Irving Shapiro in his office in Wilmington, Delaware. Mr. Shapiro, I know that you were born in Minneapolis on the 15th July in 1916, and that your father was an immigrant from Lithuania. Could you tell me a little more about your parents and your family background?
Well, it was the typical family situation of people from Eastern Europe who migrated to the United States around the turn of the century. And by any definition, they had a rough time for many, many years before they finally got themselves at least minimally economically established so that they could live a decent life. As you know from the notes, my mother came over here, well, she didn't know this, my mother came over here at age 12 because both her parents died in the same year, and she was sent off to a short-tailed relative in New York, and wound up being given the living room sofa as her place to live, and somehow or other she wound up in the garment trade and spent some years just doing that. And fate, as fate would have it, she traveled out to Minnesota on a vacation to visit her brother, and lo and behold, she met my father, and it was a fast romance, and it all started. It's the typical story of coal and a half ton lots, just as one measure of how frugal things were. But there was always the feeling that opportunity was going to knock and they were going to be all right. And they were right, it did. My father wound up with a little business that supported the family, and as he became older, my younger brother took it over and it supported that family for a lot of years. So this is the classic American story.
How did your father end up in Minneapolis?
Well, that's a typical story again. My father got drafted into the Russian army. And for a fellow named Shapiro, that was not a very desirable thing to have happen. But he served his duty, and by the time he was discharged, the family had left to save the younger boys from a similar experience, and they wound up in Glasgow. And so he headed for Glasgow, and stayed about a week and decided that wasn't for him and he wanted to come to the States. And in those days particularly, when you're really penniless, you didn't choose where you wanted to live. You went wherever townspeople were. And it turned out there was a collection of townspeople in Minneapolis from his town. And so he headed there. And it was the established practice. Those there ahead of him looked out for him, saw that he had enough food and that sort of thing, and helped him get started. No more resourceful than that. And he managed to stay the rest of his life in that one spot.
Where did his interest in the law derive?
I can't really give you an answer to that. He had an interest in accounting, he had an interest in law, and he dabbled around with it. He loved lawyers. He really didn't have much legal business to parcel out, but he had a relationship with a couple of lawyers in the city, and Well, they had an interesting case. They invited him to come to court, lost them, and they'd give him all books that they no longer needed and that sort of thing. And he dabbled with it. Not sure he was ever really a first-class expert on the subject, but he knew the terminology, and he had an interest. And on the comic side, he was pretty good at keeping a set of books and knowing what he was doing. Double entry bookkeeping was not a mystery to him. And the thing, for me at least, that's significant is that in the early pictures of him, there were always some books on his desk. Not novels, but law books, accounting books, that sort of thing. And he had obviously a great ambition to make something of himself. And I think the fair conclusion is that he didn't quite get to what he wanted to get to, and so he just transferred all that to his older son. And if I had to explain how I wound up in law school, my guess would be that he probably had a more subtle influence on me than anything else. But my own analysis is that I had no talent at all for the sciences. And I had a great talent for government, law, that kind of thing. And so it was just natural to go in the direction of where the abilities were.
So from little up, you remember your father in terms of the books and in terms of the...
In retrospect, I think in part he was kidding himself. The subjects were too complex to really master. But he would read a chapter on equity law, try to figure out what that was all about, and think he had accomplished something when he did it. And he was an interesting man in the sense that he had lots of different abilities. In those days, people resident in Minneapolis and wanted to write to relatives in Eastern Europe had to get someone who could address the envelope in the language of the country he was going to. And so my father had a steady stream of callers asking to have envelopes addressed for them. And the same, no matter what the language was, he had it under control and could do it. So my own judgment is that he's a man who probably ended up doing the wrong thing in his life. But there were no opportunities, and he had no living. So that all got transferred. The eldest son did those things that he wanted to do.
You said that he was something. He had a subtle influence. Was he ever outspoken about it? Open way?
There was no pressure. I remember thinking very carefully about accounting as an alternate to law. Wasn't at all sure that I had the stuff to do law. And when I look back on it now, I'm very grateful that I never went for accounting. at that stage of life, when you're uncertain about your own abilities, and the driving force is to get some skill that will earn you a living, those were the alternatives. I knew that there was a segment over here involved government, law, subjects of that kind, which I had a pretty good natural flair, and the whole subject over here involving the sciences, in which I simply had no interest at all, and stayed away from every course on science I possibly could.
So your grade school education and high school education was near home then?
Yes.
And I understand that as children you worked in your father's business at
school?
Well,
some did more than others. I was a business that didn't attract me very much either. The idea of handling other people's dirty clothes and fooling around that way was something you did, but not something I looked forward to, so I found as many excuses as possible to not go there. There were days, you know, weeks when I did, but my younger brother, for example, took to it like a duck to water, and he thought that it was a great operation. But I can remember going to summer school and college as one way of avoiding working in the plant.
As you were going through high school, did your thoughts turn more and more to a pre-law degree at the University of Minneapolis, or what were your thoughts?
Well, at that time, it became very clear to me that subjects like botany, biology, were something I endured. But when I got to subjects like civics, which was government, really, it was as though someone turned on a light. And I really functioned as the assistant teacher. It came that easily to me. And the same thing was true in a bookkeeping course I took, in which another fellow and I simply ran away with the whole course, and the rest of the class was way behind us. I mean, it just came to us naturally. And so that began to give me the thought that I'd better figure out where my talents were, to the extent that I had any. And as I said, clearly they were not in the scientific area, but they were in the area of governmental functioning and all the things that relate to government. So by the time college came, I simply signed up for the pre-law course and got turned on by English constitutional history, of all things, and took all of that I could get in, and was fascinated by the whole development of the common law, and ultimately got to law school, and I had no idea whether I'd last. In those days, at that school at least, policy was, if you met minimal qualifications, you were admitted. And 75% of the students were flunked out at the end of the first year. And so I figured, well, I've got one year to see whether I can cut the mustard or not. And if not, I guess it'll be accounting. And lo and behold, at the end of the first quarter, we took exams. And when the grades were posted, I was number 4 in a class of 133. And so for the first time, the light went on. I said to myself, maybe I got more going here than I realized. And then I really got involved heavily in trying to keep up that kind of performance, and I did. And so I didn't have any doubts at all that I was in the right field. But that was a world in which, despite what anybody may tell you, the driving force was economic. You had to be able to earn money because there wasn't any around. And I've often thought if someone had come around and given me a job in that period with cash, queried whether I would have ever remained in college. But in any event, I did the law school bit and did it very effectively. Made the order of the coif and all the rest, and graduated. And the question was to get some law firm to hire me. And Minneapolis was a very inhospitable place for young lawyers. The major law firms wanted nobody with a name like mine. There were two law firms that would interview, but they were overwhelmed by all the Jewish graduates each year coming out of the law school. So that really wasn't much of an opportunity. And I finally caught up with a retired IRS agent who was practicing tax law. And he said, well, if you want to come in with me, I'll give you an office. And you can get any business on your own, you take care of it. And when you've got free time, do work for me. And that's how I got started. And I can remember very vividly, I got a title on an empty lot to do some work on. Lo and behold, I found a defect in the title and got it corrected. And the bill was $15, and that was a lot of money in those days.
Were there any people during your either high school or college career who influenced you in any way?
Well, the influential people were the faculty people at the law school. The law school opened a world for me that I'd never known existed. I've been sheltered from the judicial system, from the great judges and all the rest. And once I started pawing around in that literature, sure, I was turned on in a big way. Justice Holmes, Brandeis, Cardozo, people of that quality. And I really fell in love with the legal system and the people in it. Now, in retrospect, I'm clear that I went overboard, and not everybody in it was great. And I found a test on that at a later, much later point in time when I moved from being a lawyer to being a corporate executive. I had some concerns about whether feeling as I did about the great legal lights, I feel the same. I feel uncomfortable in the business world. And of course, what I discovered, not surprising at all when you think about it, is that there were some great people in the business world too, and I took to them just the same way. Didn't say every businessman was great, but those who were an exciting group. And just to get ahead of the thing a little bit, in my early days as a lawyer, I was at the Department of Justice and wound up as a Supreme Court lawyer. I never tried a lawsuit in my life, but I was writing briefs for the Supreme Court, and finally I said, well, go ahead and argue your own case. And so I had a string of appearances in the Supreme Court and in the various courts of appeal before I'd ever tried a lawsuit, which is exactly an upside-down procedure. But I'd had this exposure to the justices of the Supreme Court on a daily basis, and that sort of was the role model for greatness, at least with respect to some of them. And I was quite pleasantly surprised to find that there were the same kind of people in the business community. And so we were off to the races after that.
Just to go back for a minute.
Sure.
I was wondering how you funded your way through college.
Well, there are two stages. The pre-law part of it involved tuition of $26 a quarter, and I lived at home, and so all I needed was money for books and transportation. Streetcar was 10 cents from home to the campus. And lots of time I managed to bum rides from people who had cars, so that I got by with a minimum of money. And what I did get by with essentially came from my father. I picked up a little money doing some jobs when I could find them, but not much really. When I got to law school, it was different. I was eligible to borrow $200 a year, loan my signature interest-free and start bearing interest after I graduated. And with $200, I owned the world. I could support all my needs, and I can remember clearly a feeling of great self-respect because somebody would give me money simply on my signature. That never before happened in my life that anybody took me as a serious individual. But it worked, and I can remember clearly the first thing I did when I started earning money was to pay off the law school on my loans on the theory that that money better be there for somebody else coming along. That's how it happened. I didn't know I didn't have money.
You got your law degree in 1941 and then went to work with this tax lawyer. I'm not clear the dates of the war. Pearl Harbor was December of 1941. Were you still working in Minneapolis at that time?
Yes. Well, got a time frame here. Graduated in June. Took the bar over the summer. Got admitted to the bar in September. And then I worked with this man from September to early December when Pearl Harbor, they changed everything. And at that point, I was recruited by someone from the federal government. Said they got my name from the dean of the law school, but anyhow, there's a national emergency. Drop whatever you're doing and come to Washington. And I talked it over with the man with whom I was associated. And he said, by all means, you know, this is a thing you should do. Besides, you're going to get drafted anyhow, so go get that job done and then you'll be in the military. And so, in 3 or 4 days, I was in Washington. And it's hard to believe now, but I remember arriving by train in the morning, and I was supposed to report for work that morning, and came out of the train station, and there was the Capitol. And I couldn't resist checking my bags and just walking around the Capitol and admiring it before I showed up for work.
You were involved in developing the wartime rationing systems then?
Yes, yeah.
At the OPA?
Yes.
What did that involve?
Well, what you have to visualize is a large bullpen filled with lawyers and administrators, maybe 100 people on a floor, and they're divided up into groups. One's worrying about sugar, another's worrying about tires, a third is automobiles, bicycles, and different groups. And what you're trying to do is to put together a rationing program that would conserve what stocks we had and set priorities for who had access to them. I remember sugar was the first one I worked on, and I remember a group that was sitting around the room trying to figure out a sugar rationing program that could be put in place very quickly. And the problem that arose was that the government printing office needed 90 days to print the rationing coupons. And one of the greatest lessons I ever had, I sat there and everybody's talking, arguing back and forth, and one of the fellows sitting there not saying anything, just folding paper. And he got it in this shape, and then he wrote something on each side. And this page was printed coupons, which the housewife would clip off to use. And it took about 2 days to print all this up and get it going. So we got the program out very quickly, and I've always remembered the fact that one man with some imagination made the whole thing go. And so I learned a large lesson that day. Well, it went on like that, you know. We set up a rationing program for automobiles. We excluded luxury cars because no one cared about them. And the definition of a luxury car was any car that sold for more than $2,000.
Which is, I understand, it was your salary, your initial salary there. Is that correct?
Yeah. That was my first introduction to the world of finance, and I was perfectly satisfied with $2,000 a year until I discovered that the guys working the desk next to me were making a lot more money than I was. And that had a logical explanation. They were older, and so they fell into different groupings, but I didn't understand that and couldn't understand why people doing the same work are getting different compensation. But the fact is that $2,000 was enough to live comfortably. We got married. My wife went to work. We saved her earnings. And with $2,000, we had everything we wanted. In those days, you could buy a steak dinner for $1.25.
I understand also that Richard Nixon was at the desk next to you at one point.
Yeah, he was... We had a setup in which we had an auto rationing group here, a tire rationing group here, and as fate would have it, there were all those jurisdictional squabbles. And so they took Nixon and said, you be the arbiter, you work between the two groups and keep peace. And he was a pleasant, inoffensive guy. He stayed there until he went into the Navy, and then when he came out, he came back, and at that point, he had been elected to Congress. His wife was pregnant with her first child, and they needed help in terms of identifying a doctor and all those things. And the team he had worked with went to work, and one fellow had a father who was politically tied in, so he introduced Nixon to Senator Taft, and the senator got on his committee assignments. Another sent Mrs. Nixon to the gynecologist that his wife used, and that's how the small little world blossomed.